ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. First, a few housekeeping notes. Please, everybody, turn off your cell phones now. If everybody checks at the same time, then nobody should feel embarrassed to do so, but you should feel embarrassed if it goes off later and disturbs everybody. Next, I'd like to tell you just about a couple of events we have coming up. We have tomorrow a lunch by Mina Hanbury Tennyson. This is a somewhat controversial book on Shanghai girls. If you haven't read the flyer, I'll let you do so, but it's women who marry aggressively in Shanghai. We have one of the authors of that book coming. We have Tony Tyler speaking at lunch on Thursday, the chief executive of Cathay Pacific. And then those of you who come here this evening have shown a willingness to come for to dinner events. We have an interesting dinner coming up next Monday. The former CEO, coincidentally, of Malaysian Airlines, which he turned around, and now the head of economic development and policy making for the Malaysian government. And that'll be next Monday evening, and we have quite a few seats still left for that. Tonight, we have a full house, and that's because I think many people here either know Mike Chinoy from his many years as a member, as a very distinguished CNN correspondent, traveling across Asia, as somebody who covered Tiananmen himself, as somebody who knows this region very intimately. He has, after leaving CNN, become a senior fellow at USC, and he is here right now at the Chinese University. So those of you who may have some good tips for him, maybe if you have some home movies of Edgar Snow or other kinds of documents that would be invaluable for somebody doing this project, I'm sure Mike would love to hear from you. And with that, here's Mike.
Thanks very much, Keith. It's great to be here. I'm actually a lifetime member of this place, which I suppose for someone who first came to Hong Kong in 1973, that's only fitting. So I'm really, really pleased to have a chance to share this program with you. The U.S.-China Institute, where I'm a senior fellow, was set up at the University of Southern California in 2006. It's a university-wide institute that does all sorts of things related to China, but a part of its mandate is to develop material on China that has both educational value, but that also can make stuff about China accessible to audiences beyond the universities. We have two very, very interesting online journals, one on current affairs called U.S.-China Today and one on cultural issues called Asia-Pacific Arts. And we're also doing a lot with video and new media. And this project is one of a number that we're doing that are essentially documentaries that fulfill this dual role. This project, Assignment China, is going to be, if it all works out, a seven-part documentary history of American journalists in China going back to the Chinese Civil War. The premise behind this project is that basically the relatively small number of people who covered China for American news organizations have been responsible through their coverage for shaping how the American public and the American political class, and given the global clout of the American media, particularly in the sort of pre-internet period, for shaping how a lot of people elsewhere in the world understand China, or in some cases, misunderstand China. And for those of you who are journalists, you know the old joke about the two things you don't want to see the inside of are a sausage factory and a newsroom, and for the same reason. But there, I think, is some value in trying to get beyond what was reported to talk about the people who did the reporting, to tell the story of those who told the China story. Who were these people? How did they operate? What were the challenges they faced from their editors, from the Chinese government, from the US government, from logistical language, cultural differences, technological problems? It's quite an extraordinary story, and I think is a very sort of unusual and different way to look at China through the eyes of the people who were our eyes and ears for so many years. So that's what we're doing. The seven segments There'll be one on the coverage of the Chinese Civil War in the late 40s. There'll be one on the two plus decades of China watching here in Hong Kong. There'll be one on the Nixon trip, the ping pong visit, the opening up, one on the end of the Mao era. The one you're going to see tonight looks at the first generation of American journalists who are actually allowed to be based in Beijing as resident correspondents after the normalization of U.S.-China relations. There'll be one on the late 80s, 1989, the early 90s, and a final one looking at the boom and the rise of China. And what we will do with all of these when we get them done is make them available for use in the classroom, for showing conferences or venues like this. They'll be should be available to be streamed online with a whole additional set of resources. That this would include longer version transcripts of the interviews with the people I've spoken with. This will include links to some of the original coverage. So if you're particularly interested in reading what somebody wrote at the time after watching them talk about how they did it, you can do so. Links to other resources from that particular period, bibliography of books written by journalists who've covered China, with the goal of making this a kind of one-stop shop for anybody interested in the issue of the American press in China. This can be used in journalism schools, in other kinds of educational settings, and also for the general public and anybody who's interested. So that's what we're doing. As I said, the one tonight looks at the first people who went to China to live there. For those of you who've been around for a while, you'll probably see some old friends and be very startled to see how gray they've become. But it's a very, very interesting film. It lasts about 50 minutes. And when it's over, I'd be happy to have discussion. I'd be very interested in your reactions and comments and questions. So without further ado, let's go. Thanks very much. Richard Nixon opened the door with his historic trip in 1972.
This was like going to the far side of the moon, the dark side of the moon. No one had seen anything of China since the bamboo curtain came down in 1948-49. And here we were, right, 23 years later. And no one had really been able to report, no American had really been able to report from China.
Indeed, since Mao Zedong's communist revolution in 1949, American journalists had been barred from China, forced to report from listening posts like the British colony of Hong Kong, reduced to swapping guesses with Western diplomats, interviewing refugees, and searching for clues in the propaganda of the Chinese Communist Party. Robert Elegant was based in Hong Kong from the 1950s to the 70s for Newsweek and the Los Angeles Times.
It was painstaking work. It was very painstaking work, a Jesuitical, Talmudic, if you would have it, but intense examination of sources. And sometimes we missed them, sometimes we got them.
Ted Koppel was ABC's Hong Kong bureau chief in the late 1960s.
It was an enormously difficult story to cover, both in terms of content, but most especially in terms of picture. We couldn't get in.
Although the Nixon trip was a made-for-TV extravaganza, and dozens of American journalists were allowed to accompany him, they had little chance to get a feel for what was really happening in China. Stanley Carno went for the Washington Post.
It had nothing to do with China watching. On the contrary, the least they wanted was any probing into what was going on in China. They wanted to make it a Nixon trip.
In the half dozen years that followed the Nixon visit, a few American journalists were allowed to go to China as honored guests on brief, tightly controlled excursions.
You shot what the Chinese wanted you to shoot.
It was not until after Washington and Beijing established formal diplomatic relations in 1979 that things began to change.
There was the full normalization of relations between the United States and China in January of that year. And the Chinese then invited a selection, if you will, of all of the American journalists to come to Beijing.
Jim Laurie was ABC's Hong Kong correspondent. He and a dozen other American reporters were granted an unprecedented interview with China's new leader, Deng Xiaoping, who was about to embark on a visit to the U.S. Jay Matthews of the Washington Post also flew up from Hong Kong to cover the event. Like many others, he was bowled over by Deng.
The interview with Deng, you know, he first shook hands with all of us as he came in. That was the lead of my piece. I shook hands with Deng Xiaoping. A historic figure was coming in and leading this what appeared to be a surge of westernization in China.
The most amusing part about the whole session was Deng Xiaoping, he had a tendency to spit a lot. He smoked constantly his Panda cigarettes. And placed to his right was a gigantic spittoon. And you would stand up to ask your question. And while you were asking your question,
what is the Chinese position on the use of force?
He was waiting for the translation, of course. He would be gargling and getting together this giant wad of spit, which just before the translator began to translate your question, he would put into the spittoon next to him. And one China scholar, when I told him that story, said, actually, that's not unusual. He used to do that to keep people off balance. They would get confused when he was doing that. But later, there was the foreign ministry spokesperson who had arranged for the interview for us, came to the three networks and said, we only have one request of you. In the interest of friendship and cooperation, would you agree not to use any of the tape of Deng Xiaoping spitting and not to use the sound? And in the interest of friendship and cooperation, that first act of self-censorship was carried out.
Deng's U.S. trip and the way the press covered it was a watershed moment, solidifying in the eyes of the American public a new picture of China, not as an enemy, but a friend and an ally against the Soviet Union.
China's Vice Premier Deng Xiaoping, who spent most of today in Houston, arrived in Seattle tonight, where he'll spend the final 2 days of his American tour before returning to Peking Monday. Jim Laurie has been traveling with the Vice Premier and reports on Deng's activities in Texas.
For excitement in Deng's Western weekend, it was hard to beat the Texas rodeo. We've got horse roping in Outer Mongolia, said one Chinese, but nothing quite like this.
It was almost like an American presidential trip in the sense that the networks and the other news agencies got together and rented a plane, and we flew, you know, behind Deng, as reporters do with the White House.
Of all the reporters following Deng, John Roderick of the Associated Press stood out. He covered the Chinese Civil War in the 1940s and knew Chairman Mao, Deng Xiaoping, and other communist leaders.
Deng Xiaoping, he was a short little man, great sense of humor, brilliant as you could be. So this little man arrives in America, and the reaction of the American public and of the American newspapers to it were extraordinary.
Chinese Foreign Ministry official Yao Wei, who'd studied English at the American School in Beijing before the Communist Revolution, was in charge of Deng's press arrangements.
Deng is a very unique person, a very deep-thinking person. I think he well knew of the past 20, 30, 40 years of animosity. And it's about time to change. And definitely, he wanted to change that.
The single most interesting stop was the Houston stop. Deng went to the Johnson Space Center, wanting to know, you know, how the astronauts had gone to the moon and the space capsule, and how, he asked, which was very typical of him, how did they go to the toilet, he wanted to know. That was one of his key questions in Houston. And then the rodeo.
And Vice Premier Deng took it all in, waving his new Stetson hat, cowboy style. And he received a gift bull, $10,000 worth of Brahma. Deng noted breeding would result in even better U.S.-China ties. Then aboard the old stagecoach for a swing around the arena. Deng, who had earlier visited the NASA Space Center, later remarked, it wasn't often that a Chinese could become an astronaut and a cowboy in one day.
That stood out as something, you know, very American, you know, cowboy hat.
And in a Chinese domestic context, simply putting the hat on was a daring act.
Yeah, he did it in a very charming way, unlike a year or so before. One of our diplomats in Washington, D.C., had a picture taken with that cowboy hat and a cowboy shirt or anything, was criticized in China. You know, a diplomat doing that, you know, it's not something you should do, especially the Chinese diplomat. Well, Deng, he didn't mind.
The coverage was amazingly positive throughout that visit. I mean, Deng Xiaoping, you cover of Time magazine during that trip, everywhere on television. This was the great reformer.
So the Chinese leave today with their memories and perhaps a new image for communist China's leading man. For Deng Xiaoping not only went west, but went western.
Soon after, the Chinese government allowed American news organizations to open bureaus in Beijing. Time, which had just put Deng on its cover, sent Richard Bernstein, who had studied Chinese at Harvard and was then based in Hong Kong.
There was this tremendous hopefulness among a lot of people, academics, students of China, ordinary people who were charmed by the Chinese culture and Chinese civilization, who found something lovable in China that they would never have found in the Soviet Union.
The New York Times sent Fox Butterfield. Like Richard Bernstein, he had learned Chinese at Harvard and had been covering China from Hong Kong.
I always considered myself really fortunate, not only that I got to get into China and open the New York Times bureau there and be with the first wave of American correspondents to open news organizations in Beijing since 49, but to have also to have arrived at precisely the moment when China was, for the first time since 49, opening itself up a bit.
Deng Xiaoping had just initiated the market reforms, which in the following decades were to profoundly change the Chinese landscape. The newly arrived reporters and their editors back in New York were entranced. Melinda Liu, a Chinese-American from Ohio whose parents had fled the 1949 revolution, arrived for Newsweek.
The early 80s theme of China was, you know, Deng Xiaoping on a roll, opening up, isn't it great, Sino-US love affair, that sort of a story.
Bruce Dunning, a veteran Vietnam War correspondent, opened the CBS bureau.
Early on, you could get almost anything on the air. There was just that novelty. It's, you know, we have a bureau in Beijing. We have a presence in China. So they were willing to put almost anything on the air.
In the early days, the opening of China to the West, there was a gee whiz mentality. If you go back and you look at the programming on ABC and NBC and CBS in 1979, that is very much reflected. China opening up. Every little innovation that occurred in the late 70s that were part of the reform program that Deng was outlining were seized upon. The first private restaurant, the first private car, the first of this, the first. It was all a series of firsts.
The Chinese are anxious, though, for anything new. Take the People's Hair Salon on Wang Fu Jin Street. For $2 and a good deal of agony, women are doing what was forbidden only 2 years ago, curls and a permanent wave.
But they wanted stories about the economic reforms. I remember writing a story about the first private restaurant that opened in Beijing. I still, you know, I traveled around the country and did pieces about how life was changing. I remember I did a long two-page piece on the restoration of a degree of religious freedom and the restoration of churches.
But the small American press corps quickly discovered that the experience of living in Beijing was very different than visiting China as an honored guest.
I returned and reopened the AP Bureau. It was the first time in 30 years that an AP man had a full-time bureau. And all the problems that were involved in setting up the bureau were quite extraordinary. The communists didn't know how to cope with this thing. They never had us there. But it was a big event, and everybody knew it was a big event. So they did everything they could to cooperate, but it was difficult.
Foreign residents were required to live in foreigners-only compounds. Since there weren't enough apartments available, the Chinese put them in a grimy, Stalinist-style hotel.
We definitely felt like pioneers, particularly those who came with kids and family, you know, to be living in this Chinese hotel that was, I mean, it was the kind of hotel where, like, the room boys would literally, it didn't matter. They would just come into your room to start cleaning, whether your door was locked, whether you were taking a bath, or whether you were changing your clothes. They would just, you know, come in there. I mean, you know, my room was infested by bats.
Graham Earnshaw was then a young reporter for the British news agency Reuters.
We were highly constrained, all of the journalists, the American journalists too, and so there was enormous frustration. We were all sort of trapped in these compounds in Beijing.
Well, how about a little On Top of Old Smoky? Ready?
To CBS's Bruce Dunning, there was an incestuous quality to life within the tiny American press corps.
We lived in what we called the Chenmen Commune, the Chenmen Hotel, and most of us lived and worked there. So we would meet at breakfast, we'd meet at lunch, and we'd meet at dinner. And, you know, we would be sort of watching who was coming and going. It was very much a communal type of living.
Jay and Linda Matthews faced a special problem. They were married and competitors. He worked for the Washington Post, she for the Los Angeles Times. Neither paper was happy.
The Washington Post had a tradition of correspondents had to sign a letter of understanding before they went off overseas. So there was a paragraph in my letter of understanding, which I signed, which said, "Don't you dare ever be beaten by your wife on any kind of story, and if you can beat her as often as possible, that's fine." And I signed that very happily. And you know, we learned, as people know when they go overseas, that foreign correspondents do team up.
There was a night when we were at a party where the Boeing representative, another American, got a little drunk and started complaining about the disappearance of one of the Boeing 707s that the Chinese had purchased some years before, when they were actually setting up, you know, expanding their commercial airlines. So we kind of took him aside and said, "Well, tell us more about that. That's really fascinating. Where do you think the plane is? Did it crash?" And he said, "No, it's in a hangar in Shanghai, and they've dismantled it, and they're trying to design their own aircraft," which he said we at Boeing call the 708 because it's so much like the 707. So I remember going back to our hotel room that night and saying to Jay, "Well, we got to ride it, and you know, obviously we have to get comment from Boeing." So we just split up the reporting tasks and shared notes. It was the most blatant collaboration I can think of our time there. And then delivered our separate stories to our desks and said, "This has to run tomorrow because," and we fully explained, this other guy has the story.
The Matthews partnership was a source of constant frustration for their arch rival, the New York Times' Fox Butterfield.
I sometimes felt outgunned, and I'd get a note from my editor saying, "Washington Post has this story, and the LA Times has exactly the same story."
Also, the only time I ever remember Fox Butterfield really getting angry at us, he came, he sat in a chair, and he said, "You guys are double-teaming me, you know, and I don't like that."
After writing their story, the reporters also found that the logistics of simply filing in an impoverished third world country with primitive communications were a nightmare.
I would type it out on a electric typewriter in my hotel room. I would get on my bicycle, would ride to something called the Telegraph Building, the Denbao Dalo. And then there was this huge lugubrious hall, very dark, and there'd be this clerk behind there. And sometimes the clerk would do the typing for me on a telex. But most of the time, I had to then retype the whole thing on a telex machine that spewed out this long tape that then had to be run back through the machine during the actual transmission. The whole thing just, it took hours. And sometimes the clerk wasn't there, or sometimes somebody was in line, so you had to wait for the telex machine. It was literally something out of the Stone Age.
There was never any censorship per se. You didn't have to submit scripts or stories to the authorities to have them go over them and vet them. But they made the gathering of news so difficult, the gathering of the stories, and the transmission. We had to, as I said, we had to order satellites a day or so in advance, and then before we could move the material on the satellite, they would ask us to play the piece, ostensibly for engineering purposes, to make sure the levels were correct and all of that, but it was obvious that they wanted to see what was going out. And if there had been something they didn't want to go out, well, there would have been technical difficulties.
But as they cover the dismantling of Chairman Mao's radical policies and breakthroughs such as the first Western-style jazz band in Shanghai, or the first Western fashion show in Beijing, the reporters found their biggest challenge was penetrating the wall the communist authorities were determined to maintain between the American journalists and their own people. Frank Ching, a Hong Kong-born Chinese who also covered the Deng Xiaoping press conference, opened the Wall Street Journal Bureau.
The first thing I had to do, of course, was go to the Chinese Foreign Ministry, and I saw Yao Wei, who was head of the press department at that time, and he said something to me that I always remembered. He said, "You can talk to anyone you like to in China. They don't need permission to talk to you." And I was so impressed. But then he didn't tell anyone else. So every time I talked to a Chinese, he would say, "I don't have permission to talk to you." And I would say, "But you don't need permission." Of course, nobody would believe it. So it got to the point where I would get the press department's phone number, and I would call that number and say, "Tell this man he doesn't need permission to talk to me."
It was forbidden for ordinary Chinese to talk to you. It wasn't, there's no law, as I say, but people were afraid. And everybody that was there at the time managed to find a few people who were brave enough to talk, and I had my few people like others did, and that was very, very important. But it was very, very hard to just have friends and certainly even harder to develop sources.
And it's because of the past, so many years of animosity. I don't think you can blame them. They're afraid to make mistakes.
The frustrated reporters did everything they could to break through the barriers.
It was very difficult to get to know people, and you would meet in parks or and that sort of thing. So it was very difficult. And for example, you couldn't invite a Chinese friend to your office or to your hotel or to your apartment. And it was very difficult to get in touch with people. It was almost impossible to have a real friendship with someone. I remember I was in a park one time with a Chinese friend, and we were talking, and there were people going past looking at us, and a couple of people came up to us and sort of said, "What are you doing?" And there was great suspicion of a foreigner meeting with a Chinese person.
I had heard that it was one way to try to talk to a Chinese was to take a train ride. So I was in Shanghai, went to Shanghai, and it was from Shanghai to Beijing was 20 hours by train in those days, or it was a 2-hour plane flight. So I decided I would take the train ride, and I could get to sit with the Chinese and get a story. But when I went to get on the train, there was a woman conductor, and she said, "Oh, you must be the American correspondent." And so clearly they had been keeping track of me, and she announced to all the passengers in the car, "We have an American on board. He's a foreign correspondent. He speaks Chinese." basically giving the warning to all the passengers not to talk to me.
Melinda Liu had one advantage. As a Chinese American with the right clothing, she could pass for a local.
I mean, I'm an American-born Chinese. I look Chinese, so for me it was much simpler, but I still had to like put on a big old great coat with the, you know, with a furry collar and a big hat and shoes. You know, your shoes always gave you away as a foreigner. So you had to wear Chinese shoes and slip out so that people thought you might be a local, because otherwise people would follow you, find out who you talked to, find out what you said.
The Matthews found one other way to make connections, through their two small children.
To get back to the issue of whether having children gave us access, it did to some extent, because we could talk to their teachers. When we took them to play at the Temple of Heaven playground, it was somewhat easier just to strike up conversations with other parents who were there.
I had gotten to know Cao Yu, who was a well-known playwright. So I thought, okay, I'll interview him since I know him. And I asked him, can I interview you? He said, well, of course, but you need to get permission. So I called the information department and I said, I want to interview Cao Yu, but he's already agreed. This is just a formality. He needs your approval. And the man said, okay, we'll see. I guess a couple of days later he called back and he said, I'm sorry, Cao Yu is too busy to see you. I said, that's not possible. He's already agreed to see me. This is only a formality. I said, did you talk to him? So after he called me back a second time and said, no, he doesn't have time to see you, I said, I'm having lunch with him tomorrow. How can you say he doesn't have time to see me? And so the man said, well, if you're having lunch with him tomorrow, then you can interview him.
Still, the doors continued to open gradually. Liu Hongxing, who'd lived in China as a child before moving to the U.S., returned as the photographer for the AP and Time.
I think that period constitutes one of the best experiences for me as a foreign correspondent. There are not a lot of this kind of hot news, spot news story. So we were able to kind of, you know, decide for ourselves and decide for our editor what is interesting in China.
As an ethnic Chinese and a still photographer, Liu found it easier than his colleagues to blend in and capture the sense of change.
And there it was, this young man, you know, roller skate by the Mao, and he was stretching out his arm, and he was passing Mao, and Mao was looking the other way, and the wind was blowing Mao's jacket in one direction. And this kind of just took just the position of the beginning of a new freer era, which becomes quite iconic these days, and it's a photograph that you see everywhere.
NBC News sent Sandy Gilmore, its correspondent in Houston, to open a Beijing bureau.
You could go out on the street and you could shoot street scenes, bicycles, people walking, the cabbage piled up on the sidewalks in the wintertime for storage, stores and shops and so forth. But to actually get into a Chinese enterprise, to go out to a collective farm, to a factory, those kinds of things took weeks and weeks often of preparation, of phone calls, of begging and pleading and wheedling with the office in the foreign ministry that permitted correspondents to actually get out and do their business.
And leaving Beijing was even harder.
In those days, you needed travel permits to travel outside of Beijing. And basically anywhere past the Ming tombs, you needed a permit. So the government would sometimes organize journalists to go and cover stories outside.
So whenever a group trip would come up, we jumped at those opportunities because you could go out and see a slice of Chinese life that you otherwise would not be able to see.
Within the Chinese bureaucracy, there were sharp debates over how much access the reporters should be given. In the Foreign Ministry's Information Department, Yao Wei argued for an easing of restrictions.
We always wanted the opening of more cities. 30 years ago, a lot of cities were not accessible to foreigners. The Information Department was trying our best to do that, arguing with them. What do you have to fear with people coming in? In many cases, it's not a fear of prying into state secrets. More of that were based on they don't want to see the poor conditions rather than anything else.
people would get very upset because they say I photograph, you know, these very low hole, you know, scenes of China, the backward scenes of China.
And the land suitable to for farming, for forestation, for animal husbandry is 33.77 million mu.
The press tours had certain rituals. There was always the brief introduction by local officials, which often lasted for hours.
You go anywhere, the head of the commune, the head of the factory, would welcome you with the pretty long speech, starting with all the slogans under the guidance of the Communist Party of China, under the guidance of the thoughts of Mao Zedong, under another.
There was the cultural performance, with the reporters often pressed to join in. But slowly, painfully, the American correspondents began to penetrate beneath the surface as momentous changes got underway.
The special economic zones are a concession to capitalism. The Chinese have bent the rules to attract a wide variety of foreign investment.
As part of his reforms, Deng Xiaoping authorized the establishment of special zones to experiment with market-style economics. The first one was in Shenzhen, just across the border from Hong Kong.
Shenzhen was nothing. You know, it was a little village, very few people.
Shenzhen used to be little different from hundreds of other sleepy country towns in South China. But Shenzhen now is a boom town, a bold experiment by Chinese leaders.
They were laying out their blueprints and telling us where they're going to build a highway and where they're going to build a Holiday Inn hotel and a convention center, where they're going to build the port. And the reaction, the silent sort of long reaction from my colleague was that, yeah, right.
We totally underestimated the ability of China to change rapidly.
Some of the most dramatic changes began to unfold in the countryside, where Deng Xiaoping authorized the breakup of that symbol of Maoist extremism, the People's Communes.
The People's Commune system, the intense collectivization of the countryside, was such an icon of Maoism and you know, that whole Soviet-style political approach. The fact that it was being broken up into family-based farms, which turned out to be hugely much more productive than the big collectives, I thought was very telling.
We went out into the countryside and showed how the communes were beginning to break up and how people were beginning to have private land, you know, their own personal parcels of land and their own flocks of animals. And so we were able to show how the cooperative, the commune system was beginning to break down.
The arrival of the resident U.S. correspondents also coincided with the launch of China's draconian one-child family planning policy. It was hugely controversial and a major story.
More on this decree from Sandy Gilmore in Peking.
Every day, China's population increases by 32,000 people. The growth rate threatens the country with economic disaster, and the Communist Party wants the growth stopped.
In recent pronouncements, China's leaders have made it clear that preventing pregnancy is the business of the state. Vice Premier Chen Muohua said China's socialism requires that the production of human beings be planned like the production of material goods.
We went to a family so-called planning hospital in Beijing and got exclusive photos of the women there, many of whom who had to have forced abortions, forced sterilizations, and so on in order for the Chinese to accomplish their one child per family policy. And went to the neighborhood where the neighborhood official and busybody is keeping track of all the women in the neighborhood and their menstrual cycles, with a chart up there stating who is authorized to have a child and who isn't. That was just extraordinary. And that was, I thought, a very important story, and showed that while China was talking about reforming, the power of the state was had a, just such a broad reach that it was formidable indeed.
But like so much in China, as they dug deeper, the reporters discovered the reality was more complex.
And both of us, like our newspapers, were really keen on what was finding out how people actually lived in these countries, looking for contrasts between the way people lived and what the government said about the way people lived, looking for cracks in the facade and certain policies like, you know, the one child per family policy. You know, early on we did stories about how in the countryside that wasn't operating at all.
As somebody said once when we were interviewing at a commune where the commune leader's wife was pregnant with her fourth child, the mountains are tall and the emperor is far away. And so they knew very well that they were going to get away with, you know, with violating the one birth, the one child rule.
But for every story the foreign correspondents could do in China, many more remained out of reach. Their struggles with Communist Party cadres, or cadres as English-speaking Chinese called them, left many journalists weary.
We were all controlled by a group of Communist Party officials, apparatchiks, minders, and they were all dressed in exactly the same way, and right across China, they were operating according to exactly the same mindset.
I think most of us who came in the 79-81 period were very, I mean, we had sort of followed China on the outside for so many years, and we were very enthusiastic about China, and then it sort of ground us down.
The personal restrictions that we operated under, you know, the constant surveillance, phones always being tapped, people always listening in on you, you know, simple things like you couldn't have a normal romantic relationship with a Chinese person.
My staff consisted of a Chinese assistant and translator who actually worked for the security people, and his main job was to spy on me.
We all felt that it'd be a good idea to be on good terms with your translator so he wouldn't give you a bad report.
These sorts of things, I think some people reacted against in a very visceral way, and they felt betrayed by China, and some of them became very bitter about China.
Living in the same grim hotels, often traveling on the same stage trips, fighting the same bureaucratic battles against the cadres, the increasingly cynical reporters fell back on one another for support.
Quiet! Quiet! That's it!
And entertainment.
Hot. Now here's a little story. Please listen to me do. It's revolutionary and socialistic too. About my dear old father. At skiving he's the best. And when it comes to Guanxi, he's got more than all the rest. More than the rest. Oh, my old man's a carter. He wears a carter's hat. He has a big black limo with curtains in the back. And when I am a carter, I'll be the same way too. And as for serve the people, I've got better things to do.
Some of these folks were just real characters with very strong personalities. And again, I think some of the personalities come out a little bit more when you're living in conditions like that and you're all sharing this kind of common bond of continual Chinese inconvenience.
Oh, when I am a carter, I'll wear a carter's hat and give out lots of orders to the proletariat. And all you foreigners will be beneath my dignity. And I will sit in your seat there and you can wait on me.
It's kind of standard, no matter where they are, for the foreign press corps to develop a slight contemptuous attitude of the host country. Contemptuous might be too strong a word. But yeah, we did have it. And certainly, we certainly shared our view of the information department, or which we used to call the lack of information department.
It was easy to make fun of the system. But the grievances of those victimized by the extremism of the Cultural Revolution, voiced most dramatically in the posters on Beijing's democracy wall, were no laughing matter. Some TV reporters, however, found their bosses so enamored of the romance of China, they weren't interested in the human rights story.
Whenever I would propose stories that touched on human rights issues, or much more critical stories, there wasn't a tremendous enthusiasm for those kind of stories in New York. Now, partly it was being television. You didn't really have pictures to tell the story. There were so many wonderful images in China, which Americans had not seen, right? That to do a story on a lone dissident, which was not very telegenic, if you will, was a problem.
Liu Qing was one of those lone dissidents, a prominent Democracy Wall activist. Several weeks after giving an interview to Richard Bernstein, Leo was arrested and sentenced to 3 years of re-education through labor. Midway through his term, a prison journal he kept was smuggled out.
He gave it to a fellow inmate who wrapped it around his leg underneath his quilted clothes when he was released from prison. And the inmate then gave it to some friends. I think maybe Liu Qing had a brother living in Beijing, so he gave it to his brother.
Eventually, the document was delivered to Bernstein, who published excerpts in Time magazine.
It was my big scoop during my time in China. We had this kind of detailed description of the Chinese, the arrest, the interrogation, the imprisonment, the so-called trial, the imprisonment, the terms of imprisonment, everything, the whole story. Was there written by an extremely intelligent, very honest guy, too.
Bernstein was called in and interrogated by the police.
I didn't name any names or anything like that during that meeting. I was fully prepared to go to prison if I had to, not to disclose any names, but it was a kind of silly bravado on my part because they knew all the names.
Liu Qing served 11 years before being freed. In 1992, he was allowed to go to the United States. He holds no bitterness towards Richard Bernstein. Still, Liu Qing's fate underscored one of the central dilemmas faced by foreign reporters in China, the danger in an authoritarian system of putting your contacts at risk.
I was very wary of trying to involve sort of an average Chinese in any kind of a controversial story. I just feared they would be picked up and jailed, and I didn't feel that I could live with that.
Most of us disguised our sources very, very carefully when we wrote about them. But we saw what happened when it wasn't adequate enough.
Fox Butterfield met a young woman willing to talk about one of the most taboo of all topics, sex in China.
If you talked about sex, I mean, it was, you couldn't. The clothes were designed to look sexless. There was no open displays of affection. There was no dancing. Sex was considered bourgeois. But I soon discovered that Chinese, of course, had active sex lives and had certain interests. And this woman was, for whatever her personal reasons, she felt very comfortable talking about Chinese sexual mores. And we probably got careless because we met probably too often. And we probably became too confident that we were able to keep our meetings away from prying eyes. So in the end, I mean, she did get arrested. That weighed on me a lot. I mean, it's weighed on me for years.
But even as Deng Xiaoping crushed the Democracy Wall protests and reporters and their contacts struggled with the heavy hand of the state, Deng continued to liberalize the economy and to dismantle Chairman Mao's radical legacy. A cycle of tightening and opening that became and remains a central feature of China's reform process. While dissidents came under pressure, Deng put Mao's widow, Jiang Qing, and her key allies, the so-called Gang of Four, on trial, blaming them for the excesses of the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. Millions of Chinese had suffered then, among them an uncle of Melinda Liu.
You know, like my own uncle, who was in Shanghai, he had been an official in the Shanghai Health bureau system. He had been criticized very intensely during the Cultural Revolution. He'd been branded a rightist. He'd been, you know, he'd been an intellectual. He was trained as a doctor, and he was sent down to Xinjiang to work in the fields.
The trial of the Gang of Four was a big story, a national political catharsis after years of upheaval. But foreign reporters were barred from attending the proceedings.
This was an amazing event. Mao's widow, the Gang of Four, all the conspirators on trial in the big courthouse just off of Tiananmen Square, and yet we as foreign journalists had no access whatsoever.
When the Gang of Four had their trial, we weren't allowed to be there. It wasn't televised live, but you saw news clips of it at night. And so then I would write my story after we watched the news clips.
The American networks were desperate for footage. The state-run China Central Television was the only source.
A major battle developed with CCTV over access to the video of the trial. At one point, video came out showing Zhang Jing in her cell, and a bidding war began between ABC and CBS on acquiring this video, which we desperately wanted. CBS, in this case, won the bidding war, and I lost.
But CCTV's display of newfound entrepreneurial tendencies was a good metaphor for what was beginning to happen all across China. To spearhead his reform drive, Deng Xiaoping promoted two younger officials. Hu Yaobang was made General Secretary of the Communist Party, and Zhao Ziyang, the party boss in Sichuan, China's most populous province, was named premier. In a sign of the changing times, just before taking up his new job, Zhao Ziyang agreed to talk to Fox Butterfield.
To my surprise, I was told that I was going to have a meeting with Zhao Ziyang, and then the next thing I knew, this man appeared in my hotel. And he came by himself, which was astonishing. According to Chinese protocol, the senior Chinese leader would not come to the hotel of a lowly foreign correspondent. So I was really stunned, and I was very impressed that he was willing to open himself up, and we had a fairly frank, engaging talk about the economic reforms he was carrying out and how they were going, and how optimistic he was and the big changes he wanted to make.
Indeed, that was the big theme as this first generation of American reporters began to wind up their groundbreaking assignments.
I would say I was optimistic. I felt that China was had an opportunity to head in a positive direction.
We were fairly hopeful, I think, leaving.
The economy was improving. The free markets were functioning. There were some private plots. There were more choices available to individuals about where they worked. There were more people going to college. There were lots of things to indicate that China was on an upward trajectory.
Even the government's handling of the media began to improve.
I thought when I left in 83 that China was just beginning to open up to journalists. 83 was when they began to have regular press conferences. The foreign ministry had a weekly press conference. That was when they appointed spokesmen for all the ministries and gave out phone numbers. And before that, none of this was available.
Still, covering China remained a struggle. Some correspondents believed the continuing restrictions obscured even the good news.
And because we didn't have the kind of access, you know, the Chinese really, they sort of shoot themselves in the foot in a way too here, because they don't, you know, they want to control you so much that, you know, you feel that whatever they tell you is a lie. Even when it's the truth.
Yet as the Mao years faded into memory, the dominant theme in the China of Deng Xiaoping was hope.
I have a photograph showing this high school student sitting on the floor in Tiananmen Square and studying. That was when they first reinstituted the college exam, but they have no electricity at home. They go to Tiananmen Square and they study under the street light. As a photographer, I was very moved.
Lights, camera, action.
One.
It's a a scoop. It's a story. It's got drive. It's got speed. It's a shock or a drama that'll make your poor heart bleed. It's a must. Stop the presses. Oh, now this you've got to read. It's a ball-tearing monster. It's a front-page lead. You've got to get the facts right, and you've got to write it quick. Just add a few fast cliches and it's bound to read real slick. You may wonder how one judges if a story's really hot. Does it grab you by the short and hairies? Write it on the spot. It's said the subs are there to stop the errors creeping in. It seems to me they're there to help the dreaded gremlin. The way they spike and mutilate, my sure is shows they're fiends. Sub stands not for sub-editor, sub-human's what it means. It's a scoop, it's a story, it's got drive, it's got speed, it's a shock or a drama that'll make your poor heart bleed. It's a must, stop the presses, oh now this you've got to read. It's a ball-tearing monster, it's a front page lead. Before you all decide you want to be a journalist, you've got to learn to drink your fill and more and not get pissed. The job consumes your interest, can consume your life as well. The burnt-out journalist lives in a special kind of hell. But the dinky-dye reporter chases stories till he drops. While there's news left to be written, you can bet he never stops. Even when the paper's put to bed and the presses spring to life, you'll find the true blue journalist still saying to his wife, it's a scoop, it's a story, it's got drive, it's got speed, it's a shock, horror, fucking drama, make your poor heart bleed. It's a must, stop the presses, oh now, this you've got to read. It's a ball-tearing bloody monster, it's a front page lead.
Well, I know, and we have. Oh, good. Now I got it this time. We have new mics. They've just installed them in the past week or so, and I'm still figuring this one out here. Anyway, that was terrific. It was practically like a who's who of FCC members. It's almost an era of nostalgia. In those days, people were struggling with cadres for permission to interview people, and the stories were these sort of profound changes. And now they seem to be more like how China violates WTO rules to flatten another American or British industry. So the evolution has been maybe from a less romantic era in some ways. With that, I'd like to throw open the floor for questions and see maybe we can get people's insights and questions. Bonnie here, please.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Engel. I write about Asian art, and I studied Chinese a long time ago. But I wanted a question for Mike, and you can turn your mic on, Mike. These reporters who had studied Chinese, they really were pioneers in America to be studying Chinese at all during the communist Cold War threat and that sort of thing. But because you've been there so long and you know quite a bit about China's history, do you think the reporters knew very much about Chinese 2,000 years of history and that they were one-third of GDP of the world from 600 BC to 1400 or something? Do you think they had any kind of referential background for what they were doing, or they were just jumping in with the language and reporting it as they saw it?
I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, some reporters clearly had very deep scholarly backgrounds. Jay Matthews and Fox Butterfield and Richard Bernstein had all studied at Harvard with John King Fairbank and had all come to Hong Kong in the early 70s. Fox, I think, got to Taiwan in 1969. Because of their interest in China, and other people had different kinds of insights. Frank Ching was a Hong Kong Chinese. Liao Hongxing had born and raised there. Melinda Liu's parents came from China. Sandy Gilmore came from Houston and didn't know anything about China, but he was a very, very good reporter. How much people knew about the way back history, my guess is probably not that much. The focus was really on the People's Republic. And you knew the limits on what you could know were that you couldn't go to China until, with very, very rare exceptions, the early 70s. A few people went in 1971 with the ping pong team and right after. And then after the Nixon visit, it became somewhat easier. Then it tightened up again, and then after Mao died, when I first got here in 75, I remember by 77, there were foreign ministry trips for Hong Kong-based reporters. Richard Bernstein and I were roommates on a trip in 1978, which went around China where you had a guide, and it was all very tightly controlled and very staged. So I think the focus was really trying to understand a country that had been completely cut off. The number of people who said going to China with Nixon was like going to the moon, I've lost count. I have that soundbite from like seven different people. They all had the same. So I think the focus was really on trying to understand this astonishing experiment that was sort of just over there, but just out of reach. And that, I think, was much more the focus of most of the reporters.
Okay.
I should say that one of the challenges in doing this project has been to get a lot of this material. We were enormously lucky that a few people took a lot of home movies, and that's how a lot of these wonderful scenes like Graham Earnshaw singing. Graham, by the way, still lives in Shanghai, and when I showed this in Shanghai, he came and he sang the song to the audience at the end, which was wonderful. But it's a kind of endless investigation to try and dig up bits and pieces. And so I will say to those of you here, if any of you have or have suggestions about where I might find old clips from Hong Kong in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, or China from anywhere from back then until more recently, I'm very open to that, because what I find is that you just told me that Edgar Snow's son apparently either did or still lives in Hong Kong. So I'm going to track him down if he's there. So this is a kind of endless process of peeling back one layer after another and trying to get both the information, but more important, the visual material. So if anybody has any ideas on that front, that would be enormously helpful, because that's how we've been able to pull all of these things together. Is you hear about something and you go dig, and I met somebody whose father was a military attaché at the U.S. consulate in the early 60s, whose hobby was home movies, and I now have some wonderful clips of Hong Kong from the early 1960s. So all suggestions on that score are welcome. I should say one other thing. I mean, one of the things you mentioned about the differences with today, I think it's fair to say that in many, many ways, China is a much, much easier story to cover now. It's much more open. The Chinese press, which back then was, you know, the People's Daily and a few ideological journals and a very rigid CCTV, which never had sound, and it was all music underneath leaders meeting and nothing else. Now you've got the internet, you've got, you know, microblogging, you've got greater ease of travel. And until a few weeks ago, I would have said things were really radically better for journalists. We've had this unfortunate reimposition of controls because of the Chinese government's reaction to the Middle East. It remains to be seen whether those new controls are going to be applied across the board, or, as I suspect, they're simply going to be there to be used as and when the government needs to curtail coverage or to act against the journalists they don't like. When I went there in the mid-80s, there was a rule you couldn't travel anywhere outside Beijing without getting permission in 10 days in apply. You had to apply 10 days in advance to the Foreign Affairs Office of wherever you wanted to go. You had to tell them who you wanted to interview, where you wanted to, what you wanted to see, and if they said okay, you could come, and otherwise you couldn't. The reality is that a lot of times you could ignore that, and there was a continual period of testing the limits, tightened up very considerably after Tiananmen Square, eased up a good bit, and then at the time of the Olympics, they changed the rules altogether, and they basically said, you can go anywhere in China you want, with the exception of Tibet and Xinjiang. and you can talk to anybody you want as long as they're willing to talk to you. And they've now pulled back on that. I think it's way too early to judge whether this is a part of this, you know, cycle of they tighten up, they ease up, they tighten up, or whether it represents a more fundamental change. But even with that, I think it is still a lot easier for journalists to operate. But nonetheless, as these latest restrictions and the problems that people have had in Beijing show, it's still, you know, you run into a very rigid side of the Chinese system that is still there and pops out periodically and makes life difficult for reporters. So many ways it's changed, but in certain key ways it hasn't changed that much.
Okay, now we're getting some questions. Here we go, in the middle here first, please.
Jane Now from CLP. Do you have any plans to send this documentary to the journalism schools in China or work with the officials there with the film?
We are actually getting it translated, and we're going to have subtitled version. There are going to be 7 segments. Some of the segments are going to be easier to show in China and some less so, and that's just the way it is. But our hope is, particularly on these earlier areas where it's less problematic, we should show. I've shown this in China a number of occasions already. And it's really interesting. You show it to Chinese students, and you just see their eyes. They're so used to seeing what they see today that when they see Shenzhen as a tiny village, you know, they can't believe their eyes. And so it's a window. It's an interesting window into their own history as well. So the goal is certainly, to the extent that we can, to share this with Chinese, particularly with Chinese universities. And as I say, we have shown this one and also the segment on the Chinese Civil War, which we're continually modifying and improving. And that certainly is the hope to make it's a very useful teaching tool and catalyst for discussion.
Over here, please.
Tim Hoffman.
Hi, Tim.
Hi. What made you come out to Hong Kong in the early 70s?
Well, I was a sort of product of the Vietnam generation and got interested in China through being involved in the anti-war movement and trying to figure out why we were at war in Vietnam, and a lot of the official justifications were that it was to counter Chinese expansionism. And so I got interested in China and started to study Chinese then. And for me, China was really interesting, and journalism seemed a possible vehicle that would allow one to get to China at a time when it was closed. So I came here late 70s. I stayed at your parents' house when I first arrived, thinking I would come for a year, and what is it now, 36 years later? I'm still here.
Over here, maybe in the corner, and then...
Lucy Chan, a former journalist from Apple Daily. And I have 3 questions for you. The first one is about the first part. I would like to know, when is the second part come out when the journalist told us that he was being, I think it's interviewed by Zhao Jiang or met Zhao Jiang, mm-hmm. all of a sudden. I think I haven't heard that story before. Yeah, I would like to know when your second part of your segment comes out. And the second one is that at that time you were standing there in 10-1, and then having all this kind of direct broadcasting in the back-to-back right. CNN 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself still welcomed by the Chinese government? Mm-hmm. In a sense, right. you have all that live broadcast at that right. time. And the third question is about Premier today, this morning, when Wang Jiabao in the press conference talking about political reform. Do you think we can trust him? Or he was just an Oscar, king of Oscar, because he's talking about training Chinese people have independent thinking. And I think that sounds very good to me, of course, but can we trust him?
Well, I'll take them, I'll do 3, 2, 1. On the third question, we'll have to see what happens. I've covered enough politicians to know that not to take anything that they say at face value. On the other hand, if somebody had said to me when I first went to China in 1973 that China in 2011 would look like this, I'd have thought they were completely out of their mind. And in a 5,000-year culture, for all of the fits and starts and 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 1 step forward, half a step back, 2 steps forward, 3 steps back, you know, there is this extraordinary dynamic of change that's underway. Sometimes one of the problems journalists have is you get so fixated on the story of the moment when the bigger story in China is the this process of change, which the Chinese have in a sense compressed into a couple of decades what it took England and America and the West, you know, a century to do in the Industrial Revolution, and Lord knows there were enough upheavals there. So I'm not able to make a judgment on that. As somebody said to Zhou Enlai once, what do you think about the French Revolution? And he said, it's too early to tell. So a little early to tell on this one. On the second one, I left CNN in 2006. I'm an academic. I don't do journalism anymore. One is in a very, and 1989 is a very long time ago, and a lot has happened since then. I stayed on in China until 1995, and I went back regularly. So that's not, I'm an academic now, so that's not an issue for me. And as for the future of the series, we're not doing them in chronological order. It just happened that we got the most material for this segment first. The next one is the Chinese Civil War, where we've actually gotten some absolutely marvelous stuff. And I'm working on a segment now on the Nixon visit, where we're also getting some very, very interesting material. So those are probably the next two that are coming out. I'm not sure when. I will say one of the factors here, and I apologize in advance for making a fundraising pitch, but the networks charge an arm and a leg and other parts of your anatomy for the clips. And you'd be amazed at how much it can go for, $50 a second, $80 a second. So we are in permanent fundraising mode, and that is going to determine how quickly we can complete this, because if you want to show Walter Cronkite at the Great Wall of China with Nixon, and you want to show 67 seconds of it, and it costs $80 a second, do the arithmetic, and in an hour-long program. So that's why all of you have that little very tastefully designed fundraising flyer on your chair, and spread the word. So that will determine to some degree how quickly we can complete all of it. But I'm essentially working backwards now, because I want to get to the older generation while they're still around. I have, for instance, just gotten the contact information for a man named John Rich, who is now pushing 90, who's the only surviving reporter who went to China with the ping pong team in 71. And so my next sort of immediate project is track him down and interview him while he's around. So we'll probably have another one in a couple of months, and maybe a third by the end of the summer, but it's going to be a while before we can get all of it done, partly because of the reporting and partly because of the fundraising.
Okay, got a question here, and two more before we go, or three more, Edith, I guess, as well. Let's try to take them all quickly. Four more questions.
Just very quickly, I was fascinated by some of the images that we were shown in the footage. One particularly frightening one of the lady in charge of the family planning clinic. I took away a very strong human rights message from running in there from time to time. What would interest me enormously would be the reaction back home. What was the reaction when the story of the family planning clinic was run? And do you have any intention to develop the human rights angle of this series of anecdotes?
Well, the human rights has been a constant theme of American reporters in China, so it's one of the topics that they covered, so it will clearly be one of the topics that we'll be talking to people about. It was true then, and it's equally true today. One of the interesting dynamics in this period that I tried to capture was there was this kind of American romance with China. It started with Nixon, and then Deng, the cuddly communist wearing the cowboy hat, they were on our side against the Russians and so forth. And one of the interesting things that happened is when the reporters lived there, they discovered that living there and butting up against the Chinese system and sort of getting a sense of it on the ground created a kind of a different, you know, perspective. And Jim Lorre alluded to it when he talked about how he couldn't sell human rights stories easily because people were just like, oh, goggle-eyed, it's China. And I think that was a sort of tension in the coverage. And then, of course, in 1989, it shifted the other way, and then I think to some extent in the 90s, I think it shifted too far. Because I found, for example, in the early 90s, that as Deng jump-started the reforms again, the story was not simply the guy in front of the tank. The story was that Deng was trying to move them off of dead center and get some of this going. And that became harder to convey and harder to get across because the power of those images endured even when in some key respects China was changing, although in other respects it wasn't. So it's a very complicated thing to try and get, you know, sort of get right.
Out there, please.
Victor Zatsep in Hong Kong. You are probably one of the luckiest people to be in China at the right time and covering such an event at Tiananmen Square. My question more is about the traditional American journalism in China, which seems to also to follow in the footsteps of oversimplifying things, oversimplifying things of, you know, like this is China is this, China is that. And as a result of this oversimplifying, there seems to be two different camps of people. You know, one camp in the United States is the one say, oh, China is a terrible place, it's a prison. Another one is, oh, actually you don't know, it's a very nice place, it's, let's go and teach English. So is there anything that American journalism during those years and even now keeps doing that is contributes to this oversimplifying of China's image?
It's tricky. You're limited by the nature of the medium. You've got 800 words. You've got 2.5 minutes. You've got a daily deadline. You've got structures that tend to favor this happened today, particularly in television. Less room for sort of deeper, more analytical stuff and. The story in China is really a process rather than an event. And so you're kind of constantly struggling to try and figure out what do you do with that. I mean, I always used, when in my own work, I used to say this: each story is like a snapshot. You judge one, it's sympathetic. You judge another one, it's critical. You put them all together, and it's like you build a mosaic. My own feeling is most of the reporters on the ground in Beijing are very serious, thoughtful, intelligent, committed people trying to get a handle on China and communicate what seems interesting and important to them. They are influenced by the news agenda in whatever, you know, in Washington, not in the sense that they follow the orders of the American government, far from it, but if the US government is putting human rights front and center, as Bill Clinton did when he became president and he linked the continuation of most favored nation trading status to concessions on human rights, which the Chinese in the end didn't give, human rights was a big story. You had to cover it. It was part of the US-China diplomatic agenda. If Obama puts climate change on the agenda, you focus more on that. You know, you have to sort of report partly what the governments are doing with each other and what the policymakers. So that shapes a little bit where the coverage, it's not you're taking a position, this is good or this is bad, but if our president and their president are talking about it, you're going to pay attention to it. And I think that counts for a lot of coverage and sets the agenda for a fair amount. I mean, you would have a better sense than I, and you're doing it now. But I think it means that it's an extra challenge to try and sort of get beyond that and get a sense of, you know, the dynamic, you know, sort of intrinsically underway in China, rather than simply reporting about policies or perceptions of China from another capital, which are legitimate news stories that powerful people are talking about, the renminbi or whatever. But it's a tough challenge to sort of get the balance right.
Over here.
Nick Thompson, no affiliation. Where would you draw the line in getting money from people to carry on this endeavor, just bearing in mind what happened to the head of the LSE just recently?
Well, I met Colonel Gaddafi in 1986. They bust us to a desert outside Tripoli. He showed up in a tractor wearing makeup and perfume, ranted for 15 minutes and ran off. So I'm not likely to get any money from Colonel Gaddafi. No, the issue is we're an independent academic institution, and so we have to maintain control of our product, and beyond that, we're trying to, like many other educational institutions, to raise funds to do what we think is important work that helps promote understanding. Political strings of any kind are tricky. That goes without saying.
So no money from the Chinese government?
I don't think we're going to take money from the Chinese government. I don't think the Chinese government's going likely to offer money. We haven't asked them. No, I mean this is, I mean all, I mean academic institutions, given the financial crisis, everybody's trying to raise money from everywhere. It's as is every foundation. So you look everywhere. As long as you can maintain your intellectual integrity, then you can explore different possibilities. That's not unique to our situation.
We moved this up by half an hour so we could meet our 9:30 stop time for dinners. Mike has indicated a willingness to stay and answer more questions, but first let Edith call one more, since I did say four more, and I promised Edith she'd get one. Then we got two.
Edith Terry, as someone who was there at the time with this generation of journalists, I just want to say that this is fabulous. It rings very true, and I was particularly pleased to see that you got the Beijing All-Stars in there with Graham Earnshaw. An observation and a question. Although this is framed as U.S.-China journalism, you have a couple of very prominent people who are not Americans, like Graham, like David Roderick, and you had that little snippet of David Bonavia dancing, although you didn't say who it was. And you might do a little bit more with that if you're still fiddling with the film. But perhaps another the question is, what are you doing, if anything, with that period of the 60s and 70s when American images were shaped by a different group that were the very small number of foreign correspondents who were in Beijing, but most notably Ross Monroe, who broke the first human rights stories and created a huge impression in China, in the U.S., running up to Democracy Wall.
Well, Ross was Canadian, and he worked for the Toronto Globe and Mail. One of the things that comes out in talking to people who were here in the 50s and 60s and early mid-70s is that there were, you're right, a very, very small number of resident foreign correspondents in Beijing, no Americans among them. Ross was the only North American. There was, Reuters had a bureau, AFP had a bureau, and Japanese had a bureau. The numbers were probably a little bit bigger in the 70s. There were very, very few in the 60s. One of the things that comes out when you talk to people about the 50s and 60s is that the people in Beijing were so constrained that in many respects there was better information. They could look out the window and tell you what it felt like. But in terms of information about what was actually going on, Hong Kong was a better place. There were refugees, there were more travelers, you had all the intelligence agencies monitoring provincial and local radio broadcasts. There was a very interesting dynamic where the reporters would deal with the folks at the consulate, the British, you know, the spooks. Is a very, you know, this is why the FCC has this wonderful romantic aura today. It comes out of that time when, and actually Stanley Karno of Washington Post, who I spent a whole afternoon with, has wonderful stories about the games of leaks that were played by different factions at the U.S. consulate trying to push their analysis of what was going on in China, and their cables weren't getting read, but if they gave it to him and it was on page one of the Washington Post, the president would read it. So I think mid-70s, sort of after Nixon, the people in Beijing had a little bit more breathing room and were therefore somewhat more useful as sources of information for Americans who were still stuck here, not able to go in except on the very, very occasional, very, very tightly controlled trip. One more. I'm happy to stick around. I mean, if you want to give people who want to flee an excuse to go, I'm happy to stick around and chat.
Okay. We also want to be able to give our staff a chance to clear up and go home themselves. So maybe. How do we want to do this? Do you want to maybe come up to here or go down to the main bar? Okay, everybody who would like, please head down to the main bar with Mike. First, let me give you this to thank you very much. Thank you all for coming, and give generously, I guess we should be saying.